Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week two of our bi-weekly issue, so I'll be reading you the brief and the opener stories. And the first one is Pressure Test. Trump's big, beautiful bill is now law, and voters can expect to hear a lot about it during next year's midterms. In the end, Democrats were unable to stop Republicans from getting their tax cuts and spending plans across the finish line. But in conversations with strategists close to Democratic leaders, they had a credible consolation spin. This bill is the most hated piece of major legislation since at least 1990, and Republicans have no plan to fix that. President Donald Trump's decision to package a July 4th signing ceremony with a showy military flyover at the White House further lashed supportive lawmakers to the red ink fountain of a law. Trump's one big beautiful bill may soon be best known as a campaign trail blunder, if not a burden. GOP strategists seem to understand the buzz-killing buzzsaw that they were marching toward with a grim sense of inevitability as they muscled it into law. Fiscal conservatives hated the massive spending and budget trickery. Centrists despised the deep cuts to programs for the poor and elderly. Parochial lawmakers did not realize until the 11th hour that cuts to the subsidies for wind and solar energy would hit their states hard, plus an industry-killing hidden tax on those clean energy sectors seemed to come from nowhere before getting scrapped. And the pragmatists were watching the GOP's biggest donor, Elon Musk, threaten everyone who voted for it with a primary challenge and then announce on July 5th that he was forming a new third party. Add on to that pile of worry the polling that shows a majority of the American public didn't want anything to do with it from the start. Quinnipiac University's poll showed 55% of voters opposing it, with just 29% backing it. Among Republicans, support was a shockingly low 67%. For context, the same pollsters found in 2009 that the bill, now known as Obamacare, had the opposition of 44% of all voters before it passed and 40% backing it. A professor at George Washington University went back through the polling data on divisive legislation dating to 1990, and nothing compares to Trump's latest effort. Yet Republican lawmakers, deferential to Trump, drove for the W nevertheless. Democrats made sure that the vote itself was a painful experience for its supporters. The internal squabbling among Republicans kept lawmakers on the Senate floor voting for 27 hours, reflecting the trouble that they knew was heading their way. The House took 3 days to wrap their work up with little debate. Among Republican strategists, there is no clear answer to how to explain these votes or to make them popular. As things settle down, the House Democrats' official campaign arm circulated a strategy memo about the 2026 midterms, outlining a plan to keep the consequences of the bill in the headlines for the next 16 months. The mega bill extends the first-term Trump tax cuts, rolls back clean energy programs from the Biden era, and beefs up immigration enforcement while increasing the national debt by trillions. The deep cuts to Medicaid and food stamp programs are expected to hurt voters in spades, and advocates worry of spillover effects that could endanger everything from rural hospitals and food centers for poor Americans to nursing homes and home health services. Congress's scorekeeping said almost 12 million Americans will lose health care as a result of these cuts. and the spending cuts are mostly in service of tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans, while leaving those on the other end of the spectrum holding the bag. By the time Senate Majority Leader John Thune was celebrating a 51-50 vote, it was clear that Republicans had turned themselves inside out. House members who walked the plank to roll back the bill, at least on the first vote, announced that they were not seeking re-election. Good day, Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska. Colleagues who stuck to their guns and opposed it became targets of a White House led by their own party. Good luck, Representative Thomas Massey of Kentucky. And at least one of the three senators who couldn't stomach voting for it decided to pack it up and head home rather than face an impossible route to another term. Safe travels, Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina. Holdouts like Senator Murkowski of Alaska, Mike Lee of Utah, and Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming all got to yes. Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Rand Paul of Kentucky did not. It's rare for legislators like this to advance, even as everyone in Washington understands it to be a political drag. Democrats, in a coordinated and careful way, found specific examples of how the cuts would hurt constituents key to both parties. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer held their caucuses together with the discipline that has been rare since November. The messaging was clear, and more importantly, it worked. Efforts by Trump and other GOP leaders to tout this legislation are falling flat. The party in the White House historically has a bad showing in its first at-bat with a new president. Democrats expect that trend to prove especially true next year. Our next article is the bulletin in the brief, and the title is China Opens Up to More Tourists as Trump Closes the U.S. Off. As the U.S. under President Donald Trump increasingly closes itself off from the world, denying entry to some tourists amid a crackdown on border controls and migration, its geopolitical rival, China, which has long been known for its relative isolation, has loosened its travel restrictions to unprecedented levels. Attracting visitors, China is expanding visa-free entry to 75 countries as part of a broader campaign to boost inbound tourism, which has already seen a surge. Last year, over 20 million foreigners visited China without a visa, doubling the number of the previous year, according to China's National Immigration Administration. China has been steadily pushing for more people to visit since reopening borders in early 2023, after its zero COVID policies appeared for a time as though they might drive the country into lasting isolation. China began expanding its visa-free policy after reopening its borders in 2023. Citizens from much of Europe, Asia, and parts of the Middle East are now able to enter China without a visa and stay for up to 30 days. China has also expanded its transit policy to 55 countries, including Canada, the Czech Republic, Indonesia, Lithuania, Mexico, Russia, Sweden, the UK, Ukraine, and the US, which are not part of the visa-free plan, but whose citizens can enter China without a visa for up to 10 days if in transit to another country. The move is part of China's effort to boost its soft power at a time when the Trump administration appears to be withdrawing the U.S. from the global stage. In recent months, Trump has moved to restrict international students from the United States and reports of tourists being detained or denied entry by Immigration and Customs Enforcement have also deterred some visitors. During his 2024 campaign, Trump also vowed to reinstate his ban on travelers from Muslim countries. In June, he announced a new travel ban on nationals from 12 countries and tightened restrictions on nationals from 7 more. He is reportedly considering adding 36 countries to the travel ban list. Next, we have a good question. Why are rural hospitals closing? And this is by Alana Samuels in Thomasville, Alabama. Thomasville Regional Medical Center was supposed to be a game changer. Situated in the United States Congressional District with the worst healthcare outcomes in the country, the hospital opened in 2020 with state-of-the-art equipment, including a 3D mammogram and an MRI scanner, but it closed less than 5 years later in September of 2024. The hospital now stands empty. Its pristine hallways are dark. Its expensive machines are gathering dust. It's almost like the apocalypse has happened, says Thomasville's mayor, Sheldon Day, who worked for almost a decade to get a hospital to open there. This apocalypse is happening throughout the country. More than 100 rural hospitals have closed in the past decade, according to the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform, CHQPR, a national policy center that works to improve healthcare payment systems. About one-third of all rural hospitals in the country are at risk of closing because of financial problems. In Alabama alone, 23 rural hospitals, about half of the number of the whole state, are in immediate risk of closing, according to CHQPR. Even more are in trouble with the passage of the sweeping new federal budget reconciliation law, which includes cuts that will slash Medicaid spending in rural areas. Tom Tillis, U.S. Senator from North Carolina, who voted against the bill, said in a June 28 statement that Congress should achieve the cuts in legislation without hurting the rural communities and hospitals. People often blame rural hospital closures on poor reimbursement rates from Medicare and Medicaid. There's a reason for that assumption. Just about every hospital loses money on Medicare and Medicaid since reimbursement rates are low nationwide. But hospitals like the one in Thomasville are struggling, not because they have a large share of poor patients or elderly people on these plans. When you look at the data, you see that it is Medicare and Medicaid that are not the problem, says Harold Miller, president and CEO of CHQPR. The problem is private insurers. Rural hospitals depend on private insurers for the majority of their patient costs, Miller says. In Alabama, for instance, CHQPR's data show that patients with private insurance rack up 65 to 80% of patient costs in Alabama's rural hospitals. In Thomasville, 18.4% of patients were using Medicare to pay for their coverage, and 16.2% were using Medicaid, and 65.4% were using private insurance. But many rural hospitals are losing money on what private insurers will pay for patient care. The one in Thomasville, for instance, was getting paid by private insurers roughly half of what it was costing to deliver services, according to CHQPR. Urban hospitals and large rural hospitals were able to make up for the losses from Medicare and Medicaid patients with what they charge private insurers, Miller says. Small rural hospitals can't do that, and they require even higher compensation than urban hospitals because they have the same fixed costs, like 24-hour staffing, but a lower volume of patients to cover those costs. One reason that small hospitals get less money, insurers demand discounts. Larger hospitals have more leverage to negotiate with private insurers over those discounts because they have higher patient volume. Smaller hospitals have less wiggle room to negotiate. The challenges among rural hospitals nationwide have gotten worse in the past year or two, Miller says, because costs have gone up after the pandemic as labor has become scarce. The federal government also offered many pandemic-era grants to hospitals so they could stay open, but those have run out. The Thomasville Hospital failed in part because it could not get any of those federal grants because it had not been open long enough. Miller says that as more rural hospitals close, communities' economies and their residents will suffer. The level to preventive care and responsiveness to emergencies will decrease in these communities, Miller predicts. We will end up with people who are getting more serious problems than they had before, and whenever they do end up getting care, it's a whole lot more expensive. Our next article, folks, is Recharging the Green Transition, and this is by Natalie Donback. The minerals found in an electric car battery often travel thousands of miles around the world before the vehicles that they will be in hit the road. Lithium mined in Chile or Argentina is shipped to China. There, 3/4 of the world's electric vehicles, EV, batteries, are currently made. The sea journey emits considerable amounts of CO2 in the process. Yet, electrifying the transportation sector, which accounts for more than a third of global CO2 emissions, is key for reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Putting more EVs on the roads and renewable energy in our grids will require more minerals such as lithium, nickel, and cobalt to power the batteries that they rely on. According to the International Energy Agency, IEA, lithium demand has risen threefold since 2020 and is expected to triple again over the next decade. The overall demand for critical minerals for EVs is expected to grow sixfold by 2040. The question is, where will they come from? Currently, the EU imports 4/5 of its extracted lithium and 100% of its processed lithium. While most of it is mined in Australia and South America, about 3/4 of the world's lithium is processed in China. But there's a growing push to build an EV battery industry in Europe and North America by recycling lithium batteries. EV batteries really represent one of the first times that we can truly have a circular economy, says Alexis Georgeson, government relations executive at Redwood Materials, the largest lithium battery recycler in the United States. In contrast to materials like paper and plastic, the metal atoms of lithium or nickel can be indefinitely recycled. If you take them out of a battery, that nickel atom is still there, and you can refine it, purify it, and put it back into a battery. And it's going to perform just as well, if not better, she says. Recycling is a question not only of meeting rising demand, but also of building a local supply chain. Amid the trade war with the United States, China has restricted exports of critical minerals, while President Trump has been championing fossil fuels, he's also trying to get his hands on more critical minerals, including through a deal this year with Ukraine. But benefits of recycling EV batteries extend to way beyond national interest. It's more sustainable than constantly mining for new minerals. A recent Stanford-led study showed that the current industrial-scale process of recycling EV batteries emits less than half of the greenhouse gases and uses only one-fourth of the water and energy as mining new minerals, especially in locations with abundant renewable energy. While the EV market is still fairly new and growing, current models and batteries will need to be retired when they reach the end of their life in the coming decades, making recycling a key strategy to deal with them, says Zi Chen, an assistant professor in energy and environment at the City University of Hong Kong and one of the co-authors of the study. China, which was an early adopter of electrification, accounts for 80% of global EV battery recycling capacity. Meanwhile, Europe and North America are still in the early phases of developing battery recycling markets, which initially require large amounts of investment, experts say. Recycling involves carefully collecting disposed batteries, which are highly flammable, dismantling and discharging them. The batteries then go through a shredding process that generates so-called black mass, the shiny metallic mixture from which metals can be extracted by using either pyrometallurgy, a heat-based process that practically roasts the batteries, or hydrometallurgy, which uses chemicals to separate the metals. The current refining processes are still quite rough, and there's a lot of room to improve and really make the process more efficient, says Chen. EU policymakers are looking to support the still nascent industry through a new set of regulations mandating producers to recover lithium from 50% of waste batteries by the end of 2027, going up to 80% by the end of 2031. They also establish mandatory minimum levels of recycled content for batteries, including 16% for cobalt and 6% for lithium and nickel. While many recyclers currently stop at producing black mass, Redwood Materials, which is led by Tesla co-founder J.B. Straubel, is going further, specializing in cathode active material, which makes up the positive electrode of a battery, as well as most of its cost. We are producing products that can actually go further downstream, back to battery manufacturers. You cannot send lithium to a gigafactory, then have no use for it, says Georgeson. The automotive industry is exploring recycling too. Last year, the German luxury car maker Porsche launched a pilot to explore how it could recycle its own lithium batteries and produce high-performance and long-lasting battery cells with recycled content, says Jonathan Hertz, the head of strategy for circular economy at Porsche. If we realize that what we want to do with sustainable electromobility in Europe, we need the recycling part, he says. Our next story in the brief, folks, is a seismic moment for the left. And this is by Philip Elliott. The world's economic capital stands to have a democratic socialist at the helm. No, that is not some AI hallucination. That really happened in New York City's June 24th mayoral primary when a 33-year-old state assemblyman, Zohran Mamdani from Queens, prevailed over former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in a seismic moment that signals how much of an insurgent posture Democrats are in at the moment. Mamdani, who became an avatar for the political movement led by Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, would be the first Muslim to lead New York. He cast himself as Donald Trump's worst nightmare and a progressive champion poised to lead a deeply resourced grand experiment. As party leaders fret about whether Kamala Harris lost for being seen as too woke on various issues, the coastal deep blue enclaves are completely disconnected from that conversation and the party's dreadful standing on the national stage. Tonight is his night. He deserved it. He won, Cuomo said, of Mamdani's showing. The 67-year-old member of a New York political dynasty soon re-entered the race as an independent, joining incumbent Mayor Eric Adams in sticking around on November's ballot. With strong showings in Brooklyn and Manhattan, Mamdani capped a shocking rise toward one of the most prominent jobs in U.S. politics. For many people, particularly those outside of America, there's the president, then maybe the Speaker of the House. Sometimes the Senate Majority Leader is in the pecking order. And then there's the mayor of New York City. To be clear, few established Democrats liked any of the viable options in the race. Mamdani's pro-Palestinian activism drew accusations of anti-Semitism. Cuomo was forced from the governor's gig amid accusations from at least 11 women. Cuomo has consistently denied the allegations of sexual harassment and mistreatment, but said he stepped down so that the state could focus on governing rather than on being consumed by looming impeachment. And Adams, the incumbent, is his own ethical mess. Still, someone has to lead New York. Mamdani instantly becomes the ringleader of the resistance. As the elective chief of the nation's largest city, with a budget of $115 billion and 300,000 employees, he would command a platform that has few peers. But it also would be a tough test case. Can a democratic socialist effectively lead such a huge bureaucracy? Much like the likes of Ocasio-Cortez, Nancy Pelosi, and Hillary Clinton, Mamdani is about to become shorthand in the MAGAverse for right-wing attacks. And on the self-proclaimed label of democratic socialist, he is about to be an anchor of other fellow Democrats we'll have to deal with. But he could also be a model for Democrats in the second Trump era, if democratic socialists want to convince the electorate that they are ready for the national stage. New York City may be the best proving ground possible. Our next story in the brief is the Texas floods. More than 100 people have died after devastating flash floods hit central Texas on July 4th. According to experts, a number of conditions came together to cause the deadly inundation. The July floods were triggered in part by the remnants of Tropical Storm Barry, which made landfall in Mexico at the end of June. When you have a tropical cyclone, the system dies, but that system still puts lots of water vapor in the atmosphere, says Augo Day, professor of atmospheric and environmental sciences at the University of Albany, SUNY. The moisture stays in the air and travels with the winds, and in this case, it looks like some of the water vapor from that remnant moved into Texas. The region where all this water rained down, Texas Hill Country, is often referred to as Flash Flood Alley. It's home to steep terrain and a lack of vegetation that creates a perfect storm for waters to rise quickly. In a mountainous, sloping terrain, the water can run very fast from the upper drainage area into a river basin and create a very fast rising river in a few hours, says Day. Downstream, people may not notice there's an intense storm upstream. Add this to climate change, which is intensifying storms, the transformation of increased temperature into heavier and more frequent precipitation. It's very simple proof that with continuous warming, we will be facing more and more events like this, says Slobodan Simonovic, professor emeritus at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Western University. Simonovic says society must accept this new reality and better plan to adapt to it. Losing so many lives in Texas in the middle of 2025 is really hard to accept. We have to be prepared and prevent this from recurring more often. Folks, that completes our stories in the brief, and we're going to move on now to The View. And our first story in The View is Trump's Iran troubles. The questions remaining over the damage to Iran's nuclear program include the fate of almost 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium, enough to make 9 bombs. But we know that that stockpile was accumulated after Donald Trump scrapped an agreement that had sidelined Iran's program, a pact that Tehran had been honoring. Trump's failed diplomacy got us into this mess. 10 years ago, I was part of the U.S. team negotiating a deal to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Those negotiations culminated in the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. It was Trump's decision in 2018 to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal that ultimately led to the perilous new situation in the Middle East. The JCPOA was the result of a sustained campaign of principled, effective United States diplomacy. President Obama began laying the groundwork for this nuclear deal as soon as he came to office in 2009. His view, shared then and now across the U.S. political spectrum, was that the U.S. cannot accept a nuclear-armed Iran. At the time, Iran claimed that its nuclear program was for exclusively peaceful uses. Yet, given evidence of Iran's past interest in possessing a nuclear bomb before 2003, the U.S. could not take this claim at face value. To get the nuclear deal, Obama and his national security team rallied the world to increase pressure on Tehran. The U.S., EU, and other allies put in place punishing sanctions. The UN Security Council followed suit with a fresh round of sanctions in June of 2010 that were wide-ranging and targeted on the nuclear program. These sanctions worked. They persuaded Iran to come to the negotiating table. To iron out the technical provisions of a deal, the U.S. then put together a team of top career diplomats, nuclear scientists, lawyers, and sanctions experts. Our goal was to offer Iran phased and reversible relief from sanctions in exchange for far-reaching limits on Iran's nuclear activities. To maximize leverage, we coordinated with other countries, including not just European allies, but also Russia and China. It was difficult, exacting high-stakes work for months on end. The effort paid off. Iran agreed to substantial limits on its nuclear activities, including to export out of the country around 98% of its stockpile of enriched uranium. Iran's commitments were subject to intrusive and permanent international monitoring. By the end of the Obama administration, the deal was working, with all the sides honoring their commitments. Trump's abrupt withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018 led to the predictable results. Iran broke free of the deal's constraints, and its nuclear program surged ahead. When Trump returned to office in January, he launched a hasty effort to negotiate a new deal, but it bore a striking resemblance to the one that he had discarded 7 years earlier, the one negotiated by Obama. One nuclear expert called the Trump framework a dollar store JCPOA. On June 12th, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tanked these talks with airstrikes on Iran. The U.S. launched its own strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities on June 22nd. Trump seems convinced that the matter is now resolved, but what will be the fate of that enriched uranium that Iran has stockpiled after Trump withdrew from the JCPOA? How much Iranian nuclear infrastructure remains intact? On July 2nd, Iran suspended cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency, closing the world's window on its nuclear program, though not closing the door on talks. Now, the Trump administration will need to do the tedious, difficult work of pursuing complex negotiations, but it will require high-level technical expertise and diplomatic capacity. And the timing couldn't be worse, as Trump and Elon Musk have a culture war on the so-called deep state, as hollowed out and demoralized as the ranks of government experts whose support was critical to achieving the JCPOA in the first place. This sad saga reminded me of what I've lost in the Trump era. The JCPOA was a product of effective and principled American diplomacy, undertaken in coordination with our closest allies. It was a team effort by countless government professionals and specialists, all motivated by patriotism and a sense of mission, and operating in an era in which they were celebrated, not denigrated. It was a victory of dialogue and diplomacy over bluster and bombs. 10 years ago, that approach delivered results for the American people of the world. I worry about what comes next. And this is by Josh Black. Our next article in The View is The Risk Report. This is by Ian Bremmer. The 2015 migrant crisis still hangs over Europe. The more than 1.3 million migrants, particularly from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq, who claimed asylum that year, have been a boon for grievance-driven European populism and its most talented practitioners. The upshot is a cultural and economic anxiety that has transformed the continent's political landscape. And yet, the first 10 years of the far right's rise have amounted to a yes-but decade. In Germany, the alternative for the Germany Party has steadily expanded its regional and federal influence, but all of the major parties still treat political collaboration with it as taboo. In France, the populist Marine Le Pen has shown that she can reach the second round of presidential elections, but has been unable to claim victory. In Italy, Giorgia Meloni, in 2022, became the first anti-immigrant populist to win a big European election, but her strong cooperation with Brussels and consistent support for Ukraine have helped her defy far-right stereotypes. In the UK, Brexit champions Nigel Farage might now be polling in first place, but that's still some distance from winning the next general elections in 2029. Centrist governments have also emerged this year after elections in Germany and Romania, despite a rise in support for the far right. Meanwhile, the Dutch government, led by the far-right Party for Freedom, collapsed in June, and the Austrian Freedom Party has failed to form a ruling coalition despite winning elections in September. For now, EU institutions are holding up fine. Pro-EU parties continue to dominate politics in Brussels, and the risk that Euroskeptics can create a gridlock remains low. In the European Parliament, the centrist coalition that backed Ursula von der Leyen for a second term as European Commission President will hold together despite growing tensions. In the European Council, just 4 of 27 members, Hungary, Slovakia, Italy, and the Czech Republic, are led by nationalist governments. But Brussels has finally managed to limit the ability of far-right governments to shift EU policies, and Meloni and Czech Prime Minister Peter Fiala cooperate closely with von der Leyen. All that said, the next few years will offer big opportunities from Europe's anti-immigrant, Euroskeptic far-right. Questions about economic resilience and stubbornly high prices remain the sources of economic anxiety for voters, even as immigration policies have been tightened and the number of asylum seekers in Europe has fallen. The long-term presence of immigrants amid staggering economies will continue to feed voter anger. The economic pressures applied by Donald Trump's trade war compound public frustration with their current governments. In short, there's no reason to believe far-right parties and politicians will fall silent or fail to score future political gains at the expense of beleaguered centrist establishments. 2 years from now, far-right parties will have their best ever shot at capitalizing on mounting voter anger with national elections in France, Italy, Spain, and Poland. In France, though Le Pen is currently barred from seeking the presidency following an embezzlement conviction in March, her National Rally Party could be able to finally sweep to power in the heart of Europe. In Italy, Meloni will face pressure to adopt more Eurosceptic positions on high-profile issues in the run-up to the elections. In Spain, the center-right Popular Party will likely lead the next government, but could be forced to welcome the far-right, Vox, into a coalition for the first time. In Poland, steadily eroding support for Prime Minister Donald Tusk could pave the way for a return of the right-wing nationalist parties to power there. The far-right Karol Nawrocki has already prevailed in the June presidential elections, and he will take office in August. Taken together, these developments would shift the balance of power in the populists' favor, transforming how the EU defines its values and its interests. The potential fallout, whether on the rule of law, security, and economic matters, internal borders, dealing with an expansive Russia, or even the future of the EU itself, remains grave. Our next article in The View, folks, is Health Matters by Jeffrey Kluger. In A Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge at first dismisses the ghosts that tormented him as mere dietary disturbances. You may be undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato, he says to one spectral visitor. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are. Cartoonist Winsor McCay made his name in the early 20th century with Dreams of the Rarebit Fiend, in which his protagonist suffer bizarre dreams and nightmares that they attributed to eating Welsh rarebit, a delicacy of spiced cheese on toast. A modest body of contemporary research has sought to explore the link between food and nightmares more empirically. The latest study in the journal Frontiers in Psychology finds that if you want to get your sleep, you'd best limit the cheese. To conduct the study, Tori Nelson, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Montreal, and colleagues surveyed 1,082 students at McEwen University in Alberta. All completed a questionnaire about their diet, food sensitivities, sleep habits, dream recall, and more. The students reported how late in the evening they eat, whether they regularly snack without feeling hungry, and if they have any gastrointestinal symptoms, food allergies, or diet-related conditions, such as lactose intolerance. They also reported how well they sleep and how often their sleep is disturbed by nightmares. About 25% of the subjects said that eating certain foods before bed seemed to worsen their sleep, while just over 20% said that some foods improved their sleep. Of the people who reported having more nightmares after eating certain foods, 31% attributed the bad dreams to consumption of desserts and other sweets. 22% pointed to dairy, 16% cited meats, and 13% blamed spicy foods. The most commonly cited medical condition linked to sleep quality was lactose intolerance, lending legitimacy to Scrooge's crumb of cheese charge. Of the people who believed their diet was related to worse sleep overall, 30% were lactose intolerant. Nightmares are worse for lactose intolerant people who suffer severe gastrointestinal symptoms and whose sleep is disrupted, said Nielsen in a statement. This makes sense, because we know that other bodily sensations can affect dreaming. One 2024 meta-analysis, for example, found that all manner of sensory experiences, including sounds, smells, flashing lights, physical pressure, and pain, can be incorporated into dreams when people are sleeping and investigators provide the stimulus. Food-related nightmares might also be linked to depression and anxiety, the researchers say. Lactose intolerant symptoms, like bloating, cramping, and gas, directly affect mood, which can carry over into sleep, powering bad dreams. The paper cites an earlier 2005 study by Nielsen showing that dreaming is more emotionally intense and conflictual when abdominal cramping is at its worst, including during menstruation. When people eat can make a difference too. Eating late in the evening or snacking until bedtime is linked to an eveningness chronotype, essentially being a night owl, which has by itself been associated with nightmares in earlier cited studies. And not all foods are bad for sleep. Close to 18% of people who regularly eat fruits reported better sleep, along with 12% of people who consume a lot of vegetables, and 13% of people who drink herbal tea. The researchers concede that their current work does not establish causation, at least with the possibility existing that bad dreams and poor sleep may lead to equally poor dietary habits rather than the other way around. We would like to run a study, Nielsen said, in which we ask people to ingest cheese products versus some control food before sleep to see if this alters their sleep or their dreams. Our next article in The View is In the Loop by Billy Perigo. Recent developments in AI could mean that human-caused pandemics are 5 times more likely than they were just a year ago, according to a study of top experts. The data echoes concerns raised in recent months by AI companies OpenAI and Anthropic, both of which have warned that today's AI tools are reaching the ability to meaningfully assist bad actors attempting to create bioweapons. It has long been possible for biologists to modify viruses using laboratory technology. The new development is the ability for chatbots, like ChatGPT or Claude, to give accurate troubleshooting advice to amateur biologists trying to create a deadly bioweapon in a lab. Safety experts have long viewed the difficulty of this troubleshooting process as a significant bottleneck on the ability of terrorist groups to create a bioweapon, says Seth Donahue, a co-author of the study. Now, he says, thanks to AI, the expertise necessary to intentionally cause a new pandemic could become accessible to many, many more people. Between December 2024 and February 2025, the Forecasting Research Institute asked 46 biosecurity experts and 22 super forecasters, individuals with a high success rate at predicting future events, to estimate the risk of a human-caused pandemic. The average survey respondent predicted the risk of that happening in any given year was 0.3%. Crucially, the survey is then asked another question: how much would that risk increase if AI tools could match the performance of a team of experts on a different virology troubleshooting test? If AI could do that, the average expert said, then the annual risk would jump to 1.5%, a five-fold increase. What the forecasters didn't know was that Donahue, a research scientist at the pandemic prevention nonprofit Secure Bio, was testing AI symptoms for that very capability. In April, Donahue's team revealed the results of those tests. Today's top AI systems can outperform PhD-level virologists at a difficult troubleshooting test. In other words, AI can now do the very thing that forecasters warned would increase by a factor of five the risk of a human-caused pandemic. The Forecasting Research Institute plans to resurvey the same experts in future to track whether their view of the risks has increased as they said it would. To be sure, there are a few reasons to be skeptical of the results already at hand. Forecasting is an inexact science, and it's especially difficult to accurately predict the likelihood of very rare events. Also, forecasters in the study revealed a lack of understanding of the rate of AI progress. Most said they did not expect AI to surpass human performance at the virology test until after 2030, while Donahue's test showed that the bar had already been met. But even if the numbers themselves are taken with a pinch of salt, the authors of the paper argue that the results as a whole still point in an ominous direction. It does seem that near-term AI capabilities could meaningfully increase the risk of a human-caused epidemic, says Josh Rosenberg, CEO of the Forecasting Research Institute. And folks, that does it for Time Magazine today. We're out of time. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.
We are now recording. I hope that this works.
Oh, now it's all.
Now is the time for all good people to come to the aid of the party.